Welcome to Accelerated. I'm your host, Vitaly Golomb. On this season of the podcast, we're hearing from some of the global leaders in everything electric and autonomous, moving us quickly into the future. Now, this is an episode I'm particularly excited to share with you because I reconnected with none other than Mate Rimac, the 33-year-old Croatian founder and CEO of his namesake company, Rimac, maker of the world's fastest car. I've had the pleasure to know Mate for almost a decade. I advised the company for several years and helped raise its first substantial financing round. And I have to tell you, it's been fun to watch Rimac grow into its industry-dominating role in high-performance EV technology. In July, Rimac and their investors Porsche announced that the Volkswagen Group will be moving the 112-year-old legendary Bugatti brand into a new joint venture ran by Mate. This was an absolute earthquake in the automotive industry. We had an honest conversation about the difficult years the very young team went through getting the company off the ground with zero experience and no automotive industry in the country of Croatia. The company's unique spin on autonomy and even Mate's views on SPACs and much, much more. Welcome, Mate. Thanks for making the time. I know you've been an extraordinarily busy person this year with all the news. Congrats on that. It's been breathtaking to watch the rise, and I never had any doubts, but I'm sure it's been quite difficult at times. We've known each other since that red Concept One. 9 years ago, almost exactly. I think that was September of 2012 when we first met, when we brought that group over. It's been some time, and we've had some adventures since. So, very, very great to great to watch you, and congrats on the new announcement. We'll talk about that in a second, as far as Bugatti and everything else. But congrats on your wedding as well. We're both married to Kate, so that, so we'll start there. So, I always like to start at the beginning to give some context to people that are listening, trying to get inspired. Is talk a little bit about how you grew up. Because you were, you were born, you moved around, and it wasn't quite as nice of a place to grow up in Croatia and the whole region when you were growing up in the 90s.
Yeah, I think, it's what you are used to. I didn't know better. So it was a good childhood in the end. But if you look at it, like when you tell the story, it sounds like, like a huge drama, but it didn't feel that way. So basically, I was born in what is today Bosnia. At that time, it was Yugoslavia. And Bosnia today is the poorest country in Europe. And where I'm from is like the, let's say, least developed part of Bosnia. So it was really like, even when you go there today, it feels like a developed country like 3 decades ago or maybe even longer, like 5 decades ago. So at that time, there was barely any roads, no cars. Electricity was not really in every home. People are living off, farming, this kind of stuff. And then when I was 3 years old, the war started and my parents decided to move to Germany, kind of more, I would say, as economic refugees than really war refugees, although the village where I'm from was hit. And I spent 10 years there. And, my parents tell me stories that I was already, as a baby, crazy about cars. They don't have, like, my parents have nothing to do with cars, but for some reason, I was just crazy about it all my life. And not having cars around me in Bosnia, every car I would just go crazy when I would see it. And then coming to Germany, all of a sudden you have a bunch of cars and lots of beautiful cars. So that's, some memory that I still remember. And then 10 years later, we moved back to Croatia, which wasn't easy as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite an adventure. My family also went through, we were refugees from Soviet Union at that point to the US. So we share that similar story. And I know it's a really difficult thing that some people go through. And it makes them stronger, obviously. And there's a lot of people going through that right now. So we'll see what next generation brings from people that go through that experience. So how did you get into technology? I mean, you were a young inventor, and in high school, you got a little bit famous in Croatia as well. Talk a little bit about that.
So I was just crazy about cars all my life and wanted to do anything with cars since when I was a kid. So whatever that was going to be, a driver, like a race car driver or a designer or an engineer or anything like that. So I was always like pursuing that path and, reading every magazine I could get my hands on. And growing up in Germany, there were lots of these like car shows on the internet, on the television at that time, not on the internet. That was like in the 90s. And, that was, let's say, further making me addicted to cars. And then when we moved back to Croatia after elementary school, after the eighth grade, you have to choose like some kind of career path. And I choose mechatronics because it was the closest to the closest to cars, because it combined electronics and mechanics. And as a graduation project, you have to build something physical. And usually people were doing like a stroboscope or an amplifier, because you could just buy a kit and put it together, like solder a little bit. But I just, as a school project, did like a glove that replaces a keyboard and mouse. So that was like in 2004, 2005. Because I believe that devices will be connected to the internet, like a television and stuff like that. And you don't want to use your keyboard and mouse to type on them. So that was before the iPhone and before touchscreens were really a thing. And I built this just as a school project, but my professor liked it. So he sent me to like local competition for electronics innovation. And I didn't really want to go, and I didn't have any hopes because I wasn't a great student. But I did it for my professor, and surprisingly, I won that. And then they sent me to the national level, which I won as well. And then they sent me all around the world to represent Croatia on these competitions. And I thought, especially there, I didn't have any chances because of all the international competition. But I came always back with gold and silver medals. I was better than I expected. And I was always doing something in my garage, building like a motorcycle or welding something, just doing various stuff. And when I was 17, I had 2 patents and a bunch of these awards. And then as soon as I was 18, I always wanted to do racing. I bought a 1984 BMW 3 Series, the old boxy one. In Croatia, we call it kocka, which is like box, because it was the easiest way to start racing. You just have an old rear-wheel drive car. With some old tires, you weld the differential and go racing. And lots of people think I was a race driver, but I actually had like just 2 races before my engine blew up. So it was totally amateur style. And that's the moment when I decided to combine my 2 passions, the electronics and cars, to make an electric race car out of that old BMW.
Yeah, that's a well-known story now. I think everybody knows about the green monster. How did that turn into the Concept One though?
Yeah, that's quite a long story, actually. So I started a business immediately, which was called VST at that time, which is like the formula for speed vehicles, ST. So velocity is distance in time. I wanted to convert combustion engine cars to electric cars, but I figured out quickly that that doesn't make any sense because these cars are not built for that. So if you, for example, look at my BMW, I had the batteries where the rear seats used to be. I had nothing where the tank used to be. The trunk was also taken by batteries. The electric motor was where the gearbox used to be, and the bonnet was empty. So under the bonnet, there was nothing where the engine used to be. So it was a total wrong distribution of components. So I realized you have to build the car really from scratch. I met Adriano, who's today our director of design. And he, at that time, he was just a couple of years older than I was. So he was like, I don't know, 24, and I was like 21 or something like that. And I wanted to build a car, and he was working at that time. He just started at GM or Opel in Germany. It was like the European branch of GM, of General Motors. And I asked him, like, if we could do a car together, that I do the technical part and he does the design. And we started. Basically, I was doing it after university, and he was working on the project after work and during weekends. And, you know, he had some sketches, I had some calculations and package concepts and stuff like that. I was still proving the BMW and doing races and this kind of stuff. And when I went to the races, everybody initially was just laughing at me what I was doing with that washing machine on a racetrack, because nobody ever saw an electric car on a racetrack. But even at that time, not even on the road, it was, you know, now electric cars are these sexy things, you know, Porsche Taycan, Tesla Model S, Rimac Nevera. But just like 10, 12 years ago, it was totally different. It's hard to get your mind back into that state, but it was like, making anything with electric cars was ridiculous at that time. So people were laughing at me, but as I was improving the BMW, more and more people got excited about it. And they were approaching me with ideas and so on. And Croatia not having a single venture capital fund, not having a, you know, ecosystem of startups, of tech companies and so on. There wasn't really anybody I could go to ask for advice for anything. I went to the University of Mechanical Engineering in Zagreb because there's no automotive university in Croatia. And they told me, like, it's impossible to build a car in Croatia. The sooner you give up, the better for everybody. The less people will go under with you. So I realized nobody's going to support me. But there was a guy who came, and he was working for a royal family in the Middle East. And he said, look, these guys are always looking for interesting opportunities. If you have something cool to share, they can have a look. I can show it to them. They might be interested. So we did a little, like, 4-page brochure. Not the pitch deck, and like the technical specifications, renderings, this kind of stuff. And he went there, and then he called me and said, they want to buy 2 cars. I was like, great, but there is no car, there is no company, there's nothing. And the next day they called me and asked, like, okay, so how much would you need to do it? So I sit down and built a business plan. I was still in university that time, like I was 21, 22 years old. And I soon after that got a term sheet. But I had no idea what a term sheet was. And I couldn't find a lawyer in Croatia who understands basic venture capital deal terms like drag along or tag along or, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really had to learn everything from ground up. And yeah, that's basically how it started. We had a handshake agreement pretty fast. So I'm now driving to the German International Auto Show, which used to be in Frankfurt for decades. And to this time now, it's the first time in Munich. So one of the milestones in the term sheet was that we have to show the car at the Frankfurt Auto Show, which was in September 2011. And we just had this agreement with them in end of 2010. And I had no employees, nothing. I was just a guy in a garage. And we had 6 months, basically, or maybe seven, to build up a team, no know-how, with no experience, with very, very little money, to design and build the car to show it at Frankfurt Auto Show, which was at that time, I guess, the second largest auto show in the world. And being in Croatia, I couldn't hire anybody with experience. So I had to, like, find guys that were doing stuff in their garage that was remotely connected to what I was trying to do, just like on an enthusiast basis, not on a professional basis. And I had to convince their wives that it is okay for them to give up their, you know, secure jobs to work for a 20-year-old guy with some Arab investors. And that's what they did. So I hired the first 3 guys in April 2011. I rented a building and we started with no experience and nothing. And we had 5 months now to build a car. And then the investors pulled out, basically. And they knew I was already with the back against the wall because they were dragging it along. Like, you know, I already rented the place. I already hired the people. I couldn't pay them. Was terrible from the beginning. And then they were like, yeah, you know, we don't want to do this in Croatia. If you want to do this and want to get our money, you have to move to the Middle East. And I was like, this is hard enough to do in Croatia. I don't want to do this in the middle of the desert. Plus, you know, I had like a patriotic drive that I wanted to prove that it's possible to do this in Croatia and to build a Croatian car. So I said no. And yeah, that's how the hardest 12 years of my life started.
So you're saying it was all easy and smooth from the beginning, right?
Yes, like butter, you know.
Like butter, like every other startup, overnight success. Now, I wanted to go back for a second. I know, well, at least you were before, you were vegetarian or even vegan. I think that also drives part of your mission as far as EVs. Talk a little bit about that and kind of how your personal mission is connected with the car industry.
Well, I have a different view on that, to be honest. I think, I'm not sure if people do that on purpose, if they actually know it and just pretend to not know it, or like they just do it because it suits their interest or whatever. But electric cars and this whole thing, you know, I don't share the view that this is really saving the world or whatever. I didn't share it from day one. And, you know, I always say, if you really care about the environment, eat less meat or don't eat meat. Don't drive an electric car. That's not really going to move the needle. And that's coming from somebody who is totally vested in the interest of electric cars. You know, I'm living from electric cars and making batteries and this kind of stuff. Don't get me wrong, it's the right thing to do, because very simple. Combustion engine has 25-30% efficiency. Electric motor has 90% efficiency. End of discussion. You know, you can generate electricity in many ways, but there's only one way to make fuel for now. Okay, there is now synthetic fuels also coming. But so absolutely it's the right thing to do. But, you know, if you look at 2020 and the biggest catastrophe in our lifetimes, I hope, where the whole world basically stopped and all ground transport, like 70% of it was reduced in 2020. All air transport basically was totally grounded. So traffic probably fell by at least 50% global traffic, but probably like 70% in that year. And you know how much emissions have reduced in that year? 5%. Currently, electric cars are 2% of the global market. And we are all, as a society, investing billions and billions and the smartest people and the smartest minds in the world to convert this biggest industry in the world to electrification and building all of these, you know, supply chains and mining and all that stuff to enable that. While there's much easier levers, like eating less meat, I think, you know, it's a much easier way to save emissions. Plus, on the other hand, it's also something that can be done immediately. Like now you have 2% of new cars sold being electric. How long will it take to replace the 1 billion cars in the world that are now fossil fueled? And when will it have an impact like COVID had on emissions, which was just a little dent in the end? 5% isn't that much with all the drama we had last year. So I'm much more concerned about other things like biodiversity and how much of the biomass of the planet is actually connected to humanity, like people and our animals, like domesticated animals, like pigs and farm animals. They are like, you know, 90% of the life biomass on like, if you disregard like bacteria and insects, while just 100 years ago, that ratio was pretty much reversed. And I pretty much am more scared of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that you're absolutely right. I've looked at it as well. I think cattle production would be number three nation in emissions behind US and China as far as emissions, period. Just cattle production itself,
yeah,
let alone everything else. So very important mission. I think people lose sight of that, but it's a good reminder. I'm really excited to share something a long time in the making with you. My first online course. Over the years, I've trained thousands of founders through my book, Accelerated Startup, and my infamous Pitching Like a Boss workshops and keynotes. Like I've done for thousands of founders, I will teach you how to pitch like a boss. And for the first time ever, I will be doing it in a cohort-based online course. This is the world's most comprehensive and intensive course for entrepreneurs and future founders on pitching. It will help you craft the perfect pitch for investors and customers. It will also help you master public speaking. Get funded, communicate your vision to grow your team, and dramatically improve sales of any product. Check out golomb.net/pitching, that's golomb.net/pitching, for more information. See you there. Going back to the company itself, when did you feel that finally you had a breakthrough and that things were getting a little bit easier? Or have you had that yet?
Yeah, actually, there were, I would say, two steps to that. Like, the first step was when the first big investors joined. And before that, I mean, it's very hard to understand which kind of situation you were when you are, like, for almost 10 years struggling for survival every day. Like, you don't know if the company will exist tomorrow. You are constantly getting bombarded by people who you are maybe late paying or didn't pay on time, which is a terrible situation. Not salaries, but like suppliers or rent or whatever. That was the hardest thing for me. Like, because you are constantly on this knife's edge between survival and still progress, you know, and that's difficult to do. And I'm a risk taker, so sometimes you take a little bit more risk than you can actually handle, and then you get into difficult situations. And then finally, when we got the first serious investors behind us after a long time, and that was already like 250 employees or something like that in the company. So I was bootstrapping basically this company before that. And, you know, not having to worry about the next salary, at least for some period, that was like, wow, you know, it was a feeling I didn't have before. And I could focus a little bit on other things other than fundraising and just, you know, making sure we make it to next week. So that was like step one when, you know, Porsche and Hyundai and these guys invested. And now I have the feeling that we are on the next step, like where we have the snowball effect. Like things are just like all the hard work of the last 12 years kind of, you know, built up into the snowball. And now the snowball is getting bigger and opportunities are coming to us. You know, we are super sexy for employees. Investors are coming to us. Like it's all there. Like, you know, you don't have to introduce yourself anymore. You don't have to do cold calls, cold emails, whatever. Everybody wants to meet you and they reach out to you. And, you know, that's the difference.
It's a hell of a difference. I remember our trip, the emergency trip to China back in 2016.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the worst situations, actually. One of the, actually, my worst year in my life. But there were many like that, where the company was just barely, like through the needles, you know, had made it through.
Now, the Nevera, the car is very well known now. And I remember first time you and Adriano showed me those sketches, the secret sketches, a few years ago, and this Concept 2 project. But the business, you know, everybody knows Nevera. The company is now very mainstream as far as popularity, but the business, still most of the business is working with other OEMs. Talk a little bit about kind of some of the things that you can talk about at this point that's out there, some technology under the hood. What can you tell our audience about that?
Yeah, that was also quite an interesting moment. So Marco, who's sitting here next to me, is an instrumental part to that. So he's a driver now, but so when he walked into the company for the first time, that was like 8 years ago, we were like 30 people. We had some prototypes on the benches that we were doing for some car companies and so on. Like it was more like, let's say, the suppliers of the auto industry and not like the companies, the car manufacturers themselves. So it was, let's say, the second tier. And when he came, we defined a strategy. Like, you know, before that I was just doing whatever came to me and whatever opportunity I could get. But then we defined a strategy that we want to be a technology supplier and develop and produce key components for the big players of the auto industry, like, I don't know, Ferrari, Porsche, Mercedes, BMW. And I was thinking to myself at that time, okay, you know, this sounds really good, but we are 30 guys in the middle of nowhere, somewhere in Croatia, with a 20-something-year-old CEO with no experience in this. Why the hell would these guys come to us? And, you know, lots of little steps, a million little steps to that. And then a couple of years ago at the Geneva Auto Show, you know, you never actually realize with these micro steps that you actually came somewhere. So Marco actually said when we were there in Geneva, like, ah, look around us. You know, there's a bunch of cars having our technology in them, like our battery or our powertrain here in Geneva. Like, we have our car exhibited here with pretty much everything developed and made in-house. And we have all the right customers, all the big car companies, all the, you know, management board members coming to our stand talking about exactly the right kind of projects that you want. Like, that strategy from 8 years ago that was so, let's say, incredible at that time, actually, it's executed, tick in a box. We actually managed to do it. So now, as you say, the main business is, it's actually two businesses. On one side, the hypercar business, which is now not just the Nevera, but also we took over the responsibility for Bugatti, which is a pretty big thing. I guess we'll discuss that as well. And on the other side, developing the technology for our own hypercars, yes, but also for, or primarily for many other OEMs, including our shareholders, which is Porsche and Hyundai and so on. And it's basically helping them to go hybrid and electric, or even hydrogen in some cases, faster and better. And also kind of to make sure that the cars they are making are fun and exciting. And, you know, not just, let's say, greenwashing, but also to help them make cars that are really cool, also for people who love cars like you and me.
Yeah, I remember that was a big pivot. I think that was easier to explain to investors when we had having those discussions. The hypercar business is very small, but building the vision of being the next Bosch, not the next Ferrari, per se, that's the line that we use, right? So I think that that was easier for investors to understand, to become supplier for this industry. And that seems to have worked out quite well. So you mentioned the Bugatti deal. That's a really big deal, obviously. Talk a little bit about how that came together and what, you know, what the structure is, because it's not a straight ahead structure that you can that is too easy to understand. When it was announced, I remember the chart with all the different tentacles. So talk a little bit about that deal and all of that.
So basically, I read somewhere when a big corporate invests in a small company as a strategic investment, that like in 95% of the cases within 3 or 4 years, the partnership falls through because the expectations were not right. The startup didn't deliver, the interests were not aligned, and so on. In our case, Porsche invested for the first time in their history into a startup, which was us, after, by the way, 3 years of due diligence, three times, doing it the very proper German way, which was quite difficult for us. And by, you know, over-delivering on our promises to them and showing them whatever we promised that we would do, we gained really their trust. And they, you know, they, I mean, a big company doesn't have a single opinion. There's lots of opinions in a company. And there are lots of critics of, like, why would Porsche need us? You know, it's Porsche after all. It's the sports car company. Why would they need a little, you know, shady company in Croatia? So we converted a lot of the naysayers through support to supporters and to fans of the company and people who love to work with us by just doing our job and delivering on what was expected of us and what we promised. So the support grew, and we did also the investment. So Porsche invested 2 times more into the company, which is very rare, I would say. And I think, you know, the support within Porsche just grows, because whatever they throw at us, and where many people say, look, it's too big of a risk, we cannot take this risk, we actually deliver. And as Porsche is part of the Volkswagen group, of course, word comes around. And oftentimes I felt like, you know, a tourist guide, just drive, you know, giving company tours and factory tours to executives from the Volkswagen group, from Audi, from Volkswagen. So there was a lot of awareness about what we were doing. And lots of people in the Volkswagen group knew about that. And they considered us like, you know, this agile, lean, little bit crazy guys that were doing things in a different way. And oftentimes big companies are frustrated, or people in the big companies are frustrated by how things are working within the company. And they know their limitations sometimes, like, or where they need to focus. So Volkswagen, after the Dieselgate scandal, they really went all in into electrification. Not as some, you know, like greenwashing marketing exercise, but actually they are all in, really, and I can see them from inside. They're really going completely off the electric cars. And Bugatti just doesn't fit in there with their strategy, because they don't have the technology to equip a hypercar with a powertrain. And doing it the Volkswagen way, electrification would just cost billions, electrification of Bugatti. So this was one of the rare instances where there was a win-win-win situation. Win for Volkswagen, win for Bugatti, and win for us, where it was super positive for everybody. Bugatti has a secured future, where without us, that might be questionable. Rimac has a very strong brand to, you know, exploit our lean way of working and the technology that we have. And Volkswagen has somebody who takes care in a very entrepreneurial way about one of their key assets. And it's the first time something like that happened. And many people told me, like, the auto industry has changed so much. Like, a deal like this 10 years ago would have been unimaginable, that Volkswagen, the biggest company in Europe, not car company, biggest company in Europe, which has 4 times the revenue of Croatia's GDP, decided to give one of their brands to, I mean, give, it's not a gift, but basically do the transaction where we take over the leadership for Bugatti. How it actually started, it was on a meeting where the head of strategy of the Volkswagen group called me to talk about Bugatti, I thought that he wants to talk about the project we were doing for them. We were working on a concept for an electric car. And in the middle of me presenting to him what I was doing on that project, he asked me, like, what do you think about taking the company over, like Bugatti over? And I thought it was a joke, and I kind of ignored it. And 3 months later, he called me and asked, like, okay, Mate, so did you think about my proposal? And I was like, oh, it wasn't a joke. So that's when he basically started to work on it. And it was basically 3 years ago almost, yeah.
So it took some quite a long time as well to get this deal done.
It's a lot of stakeholders. It's a lot of opinions again. It's a lot of different interests. It's unions. So it's a lot of stakeholders, so lots of different groups that have all their opinion and their interests and so on. And of course, it takes a lot of time. And such a big company is also very cautious about, you know, their reputation and their every move they make, especially after the Dieselgate scandal. There is a zero risk policy in terms of, you know, legal risks and so on. So antitrust and stuff like that has been big topics. Lots of new terms that I have learned and new things in this whole process. And it's interesting to do, you know, such a deal with one of the biggest companies in the world. Like, that's some things you can't learn anywhere, I guess. So, yeah, it was an interesting journey. And, like, right until the end, we didn't know if it was going to go through or not. Like, because there were people who were against it and people who were for it. But in the end, I think the deal just makes so much sense for everybody involved. So that anything else would have been just such a shame if it didn't go through.
Well, it's fantastic. It's a earthquake in the auto industry, and looking forward to seeing the first electric Bugatti. That'll be quite a sight.
Yeah, absolutely. There will be different things that people might not expect, but you'll see.
When companies start to catch fire in Blitzscale and look for capital to fuel that growth, or look to find the right exit strategy, they often seek the counsel of investment bankers. At Drakestar Partners, we work with some of the leading companies in global tech on capital raises, M&A, corporate carve-outs, SPACs, and much more. And we're pretty good at it. Our team of over 100 technology sector experts across 9 offices in 6 countries is comprised of not only career bankers, but experienced executive, venture investors, and technologists. Drakestar Partners is the number one ranked and fastest growing mid-market investment bank across US and Europe. While I focus on mobility and energy transition sector, along with all things Silicon Valley, my partners from the Pacific to the Atlantic and around the world lead in software, media, communications, and everything in between. Learn more about us at drakestar.com. The other thing is that by my count, you and RJ Scaringe of Rivian are the two youngest CEOs in the auto industry and, you know, major funded companies, and you beat them by about 5 years. What do you think is different about the mentality of millennials running these companies now than kind of the old guard?
Yeah, well, I met also some other younger guys who are very different from RJ and myself. I think that RJ and myself are quite similar, but I think there are other black sheep in the industry as well, and that do things quite differently. I mean, there's so much money being thrown after the this segment right now. You know, when I think about the struggles that we have and how much, you know, $10,000 meant to us, and then, you know, now there is companies with nothing raising billions. It's quite strange. But RJ is one of those who has really, one of the very few who has a lot of substance and integrity. And it's really cool what these guys are doing. And I'm happy that we are also friends. What we are doing differently, I think, is, you know, not being from the industry is, I think, a blessing sometimes. You are not, you're really, you know, looking at it, as Elon often says, as, you know, first principles, and look really at what makes sense and what doesn't. But one thing, you know, I kind of dislike is this notion that startups in Silicon Valley are so much better at this than the stupid big old companies. Because if you look at it, you know, if you look at how much some of these big EV startups have raised, how many billions, and how long it took them to bring the first product on the market, and very, very few actually did that yet. And then compare it to how much automotive companies actually need to bring a new product to the market, and how much money it takes. Startups are not more efficient. It's actually the other way around. So I kind of feel a little bit bad for that, where everybody just assumes like, yeah, you know, this big heavy companies, they don't know a thing. Here are the young smart guys, they'll do everything better. Making cars is difficult. And we can see that on Tesla, and we can see that everywhere else. So, you know, it's a huge job that many of the people in the industry are doing, the newcomers. But let's not, you know, disregard the experienced folks, as we would say it in Croatia, here, who have done it for decades and doing a very hard job, which is developing and building cars. But what's the different approach? I think it's just maybe also not having the legacy, you know, when you don't have to worry about dealers and unions and supply chains and factories that produce pistons and gearboxes for combustion engine cars and so on. It's also a very big thing when you don't have to do that, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people compare making a car to like contracting out assembly of an iPhone or another smartphone, but it's much, much more complex than that. And, you know, the EV is finally a no-brainer, right? Everybody's going electric. We're finally at that point where you don't really have to sell that idea. But autonomy is still a lot more fuzzy. What are your thoughts on autonomy?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Electrification is like, you know, it's not even a discussion anymore. It's like it's the thing. There is no more, you know, I used to have so many of these discussions. Is electric really the future? Will combustion engine cars become electric and so on? Yeah, okay, that's done. Okay, we are not talking about this anymore. And to be honest, it's really a small change. Like everybody stays in their kind of comfort zone. Everybody, like the suppliers make parts, the car companies make the cars, they sell it to the dealers sell it to the end customers, you know, that's it. It doesn't really matter for the car company if they install an exhaust pipe from supplier A or a battery pack from supplier B, or even from the same supplier. It can also happen. So they're still in their comfort zone while feeling that everything is changing. The real big change is autonomous driving and new, actually not even autonomous driving, but more, I would say, the new mobility landscape, where people don't own cars anymore. They are just users of the service. And that's really the big, big change. And autonomous driving and electrification are two enablers of that. So I'm really a big, how would I say, fan of that. And I really think this will bring the change. And this will also bring the environmental change and social change to society. Just, you know, like phones, you know, the iPhone didn't disrupt just Nokia, but actually changed our lives. It changed the way everybody of us lives their daily life. And, you know, electric cars like Tesla is now disrupting the big OEMs in the same way like the iPhone disrupted Nokia. But that's just step one. The real change to society is going to be in this new mobility, where, you know, it doesn't anymore matter how far you live from the city or from your work, because you are basically using your time productively while you are in the vehicle commuting, because you need screen time anyways to do your emails, to your stuff, to relax, to watch a movie, whatever. So once you are in that robot vehicle, you are not really caring so much anymore. If the ride takes 20 minutes or 40 minutes, you are going to be productive anyways. That changes cities, that changes real estate, that changes infrastructure. Infrastructure is going to be used much better. There will be more pedestrian zones in cities, less pollution, you know, all that stuff. There's so many things that you cannot imagine. Just you couldn't imagine, you know, that we would have this conversation now on a phone in 2005 or 2007 when the iPhone was announced. In the same way, you cannot really imagine how this new shift in mobility will change society.
And you guys have taken a different approach to autonomy, right? You're not making a hypercar that is supposed to be fun to drive completely autonomous. You have a track coach. You haven't talked about that feature too much publicly. I don't know, maybe there's something you can add on that, a little bit more detail on what that's going to be like.
Actually, a professor from Stanford told me, I think it was like in 2015, the company who doesn't have an AI team, like 3 years from now, will be like totally irrelevant, will go to oblivion. And I was thinking at that time, okay, so what could we do with autonomous driving and if we don't compete with like Waymo and these kind of guys? And I thought, you know, we don't want to do like the same thing that these guys are doing because there's so many billions thrown at trying to achieve the same thing, transporting from point A to point B. And there's so many companies trying to do that. And it's such a huge challenge. We don't have a chance there. Even at the time when it was very tempting and there was many companies raising lots of money and achieving huge valuations, I didn't really want to do that and get into that game. So we decided for something else and apply it in a way where we were more home in high performance. So the idea is you might have the money to buy a sports car, but you probably don't have the skills to use it properly. And with the driver coach, you have a very high performance autonomous driving system for track use, where you go onto the track and the car can show you perfect laps around the track. And you don't have to do anything. It can show you like a Formula One driver is driving you around, show you the capabilities of your car. And then when you take over, it actually gives you instructions on how to be a better driver, how to brake better, steer better, everything about the braking points, turning points, and this kind of stuff. Yeah, so that system is still in development. We have a supercomputer in the car, NVIDIA. We are doing all the software. We have 13 cameras, 6 radars, this kind of stuff. Yeah, and it's a pretty cool feature. And then also, you know, it can also be used to solve other things because when you have such a system, it has to react like, you know, incredibly fast. Because when you drive like 300 kilometers per hour on the track, you are passing lots of, you know, meters in a short amount of time or per second. So yeah, there's lots of challenges that come with that.
I wonder if it's going to yell like every track coach I have ever had, you know, brake, 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 turn in, turn in.
Yeah, something like that. But I hope one day you can choose, like if you want to have, you know, a certain race driver as your coach or another one, your favorite race driver.
Mate, I don't know if you know or if you've noticed on Twitter, there's a lot of speculation because you and I know each other and have done some work together before. The whole world of SPACs is speculating that Remats will be going in that direction as well. Can you share some ideas? What do you think about the SPAC market and anything that you can share publicly?
Does anybody want to be a public company CEO?
Not if they know what's good like for them.
Yeah, I don't think that's, you know, such a wise personal choice, but I think it's a necessary business choice. You know, I always said, Marco and myself always saying that we are building a company for 100 years. If you look at Porsche, it's 70 years old. If you look at Ferrari, it's, I think, similar. Bugatti is 112 years old. So we are really in for the long run and, you know, not the hit and run thing. So when this whole spec thing came up, I was like, you know, we are not going to be part of this because it's going to be crashing down. Not everywhere, not in all cases, but because there was lots of companies that were absolutely overpromising on levels you can't imagine. And I think people are seeing some of that right now. And then when it comes to IPO, that was like our long-term plan. But at some point, it was so tempting because there were so many companies that were far behind us in maturity, raising so much more money than us, that we, you know, were in a disadvantaged position. So we were thinking about SPACs, but we have decided against it because we think that there will be some not so nice surprises in the SPAC market. Of course, not discrediting every SPAC. I think there's many great SPACs, many great companies that have done a SPAC, but also many that haven't, that weren't a great company. So rather, we'll most probably do an IPO, but in a few years' time, when we have really the fundamentals sorted out, also like close the deal or like integrated Bugatti properly and built the campus and achieved a few more milestones. And then I think it's the right time for an IPO. Not because I want to be the CEO of a publicly run company, but it's the right thing to do for a company. And that's always what should be the first priority.
Yeah, definitely an exercise in accountability in a big way on a quarterly basis. So I wanted to ask you one last question. You know, you've gone through quite a journey. since I've known you in these years, almost the entire history of the company, almost, not quite, but you've grown a beard. You've always said that publicly to look a little bit older in this space. And you've gotten a little bit of a silver hair as well, I've noticed, through this process, because it's not easy. What advice would you give your 17-year-old self, you know, starting out, knowing what you know now?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. You know, I basically sacrificed a lot of my life to build this company. I don't regret it. I think it was exactly as it should have been. If I would go back now, I'd do everything differently. But I guess if I would start with the knowledge I have now, probably I would screw up somewhere. I guess it just had to be exactly as it was. Maybe I would worry less about competition going back, because I always had a feeling like, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing and have so little funding and everything. There will be all these companies chasing after the same thing and they'll be much faster and so on. And then I rushed a few things rather than doing them properly. So I think if I hadn't worried so much about competition, which 12 years later is still not there, by the way, so we are still the only game in town when it comes to this super high performance electrification. I think that's one of the things that I would have changed. Other than that, I don't know, maybe I would have done it in a country where it was somewhat easier. I guess that's some of the things that I think, you know, you just learn so much. I think every year I'm a different person and I'm actually running a different company because of the rate of growth. So there's just so much of learning. And, you know, if I had this experience, I would do everything differently.
Yeah, that's always it's always fun to look back, right? But you're still you've got many, many years ahead of you. I think it's gonna be interesting to watch how the company develops, yeah. How you change. You know, you become co-CEO of the country of Croatia to add a few things to your plate. You certainly are quite a hero. I hope most people realize how much you're bringing to the country. We were talking about before hitting record. I just came back from sailing the islands there for a week, which is a big bucket list item for everyone. So fantastic place to do it. Anything we missed? Any last words you wanted to add that would be inspiring to other entrepreneurs?
Well, I think we covered it pretty well. I just think, you know, I think many people are saying that, but perseverance is really everything. And, you know, most of the time, this is not a fun job. And it's like, I mean, it depends what you want to do. If you want to do this for 10, 15 years and cash out and live like a dog for 15 years and then enjoy life, that's fine. But I guess that's, you know, people with that kind of attitude will not get far. It's a long-term game. You won't do anything in 2 or 3 years. So I think you have to be in it for the long run. And it's pretty miserable often, but also rewarding. So people have to be ready for that compromise and, you know, live with that every day.
That was our conversation with Matej Rimac, CEO of Rimac Technology and Bugatti Rimac Cars. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to give us 5 stars in your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. See you in the next one. And in the meantime, you can always find me at golem.net.